This November marks the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Built to stop the flow of people from east to west, the wall came to symbolise the ideological divide between communist Soviet bloc and the Western democratic capitalism. Years on, East Germany still lags the West. But after four decades of socialism, just how big was the economic gap between East and West? Whilst East Germany experienced an economic miracle and became one of the world's economic powerhouses, in 1989 the East German economy lay in shambles. But is this perception correct, or is it sometimes overblown? How different really was the standards of living between East Germany and West Germany, and what did it take to overcome the legacy cost after 1989? Today, according to some surveys, many people in Central and Eastern Europe say they miss the good old days of socialism, or at least important aspects of it. Some seem to have buyer's remorse, disappointed with the results of economic liberalisation. Does this show that capitalism is not that great after all? If people still look back fondly on the days of state socialism, can we truly say that we've won the argument? It's true to say that socialist ideas have had somewhat of a resurgence in our own country. Proponents often say young people argue that this time around socialism could be different. And when challenged, they say that Marx never advocated any of the terror, the coercion, the loss of life that's incurred under Soviet rule, nor leads to coercion and the stamping out of freedoms. So is Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell right? That blaming all socialists for the terror and death is like blaming all Catholics for the Inquisition. Well, joining me, Darren Grimes, digital manager at the IEA, to discuss the legacy of the Berlin Wall's fall is the IEA's head of political economy, Dr. Christian Niemitz, who's also the author of Socialism, the Failed Idea That Never Dies. Hello, Christian.
Hello.
Now, Christian, I wonder if we might start by discussing whether or not you think, I mean, was there ever a real expectation that the Berlin Wall would fall? What did the Berlin Wall actually mean for the West?
I don't think there was an expectation. There was a West German journalist, can't remember his name, who was writing about that possibility in the late 80s. And he was laughed at the time. This was dismissed as idle dreaming. The perception at the time was that maybe something is going to happen in the Eastern Bloc. Maybe there would be some relaxation, but that the Eastern Bloc as such would persist. So I certainly don't remember anyone in my family expecting this. I didn't understand the geopolitics of it at the time, but I do remember that my parents showed it to me on a map, saying, look, there are two German states. This is us. We're the Federal Republic, and this is the GDR. But to them, that was just like, that was just another part of the world where they happened to speak the same language. It was like a poor version of Austria or Switzerland. Otherwise, they definitely had no expectation that there would ever be a reunification.
And was it with your family then, on that personal aspect, were there tears? Were there, what did reunification actually mean? Was it celebrated? Was it something to be welcomed?
Well, if you're looking for anecdotes of that kind, I'm afraid I have to disappoint you.
Oh,
for us, East Germany was light years away. My parents were born after the division, mm-hmm. and for them that was just the norm. For them, the Federal Republic was the whole of Germany, mm-hmm. and that was for them the way it was. They had no memories of a united Germany. Mm-hmm. So no, for us it wasn't a big deal at the time.
So did the wall ever symbolize anything for you or your family, or was it just part of daily life? It was just accepted. The wall was the wall. East Germany was East Germany. It was totally different to the West.
Yes. I think more generally, it symbolized, it was at least around the time it was built in the West, it was seen as an admission of failure, that if you have to wall in your own people, then clearly you've done something wrong. And for a while, it was a PR problem for socialists that, mm-hmm. Of course, they could always say, well, this isn't our kind of socialism, but nonetheless, that argument is a bit less powerful if you have such a powerful symbol of the failure of socialism. Now, even if you say, I'll do it a bit differently, you'd have to do it very, very differently.
Yeah. Now, I wonder if we can talk about the major economic differences between the East and West. I mean, at the time, but even after the wall coming down 30 years on. Have economic conditions massively improved since then? And what were the variations in economic output and standards of living at the time and now?
Well, around the time of reunification, when the eastern states became integrated into the German system of national accounts, that's the first time that we can compare figures properly, output per capita in West Germany was three times higher than in East Germany. So that's a colossal difference. If you compare this to anything we're talking about today, when we're talking about the possible gains of a UK-US trade deal or the possible cost of getting Brexit wrong, things like that, we're talking about a couple of percentage points of GDP. But if you have one economy being three times richer than another, that is an absolutely colossal difference. And that was built up just over the course of one generation. It was just 40 years, the division. So that shows you that if we ever get a Korean reunification, that is going to be the same thing on a vastly bigger scale even.
Mm. And what was responsible then for the economic miracle in West Germany? Was it just Keynesian, you know, pumping loads of money into it that was borrowed from the Americans? What was it? What was responsible?
No, there wasn't a lot of borrowing from the Americans. That's one of the founding myths, the Marshall Plan. Actually, the Marshall Plan was something like 1% of West German GDP per year, and it was fully paid back in the 60s already. That wasn't it. I mean, that was more what Britain did, going down the Keynesian route. West Germany went for a relatively liberal economic system, at least initially, got diluted later, but Ludwig Erhard, the first minister of the economy, was a liberal of sorts, and he made the case for a market economy initially pretty much single-handedly. The Conservative Party at the time was very interventionist. They wanted to do something more similar to what happened in Britain, a mixed economy with large-scale nationalized industries, and he and some of his fellow travelers turned that around. It was the liberal market economy and the planned economy in the East that drove the two states apart.
Now, for some people, the wall brings back memories of, you know, gun turrets and people being blocked in or caved in and not being let out. And as you eloquently put it earlier, the idea of having to trap people somewhere doesn't suggest that it's somewhere that anyone else would quite like to live. But if you look at the polling on, if you look at outside of East Germany, communist dictators like Stalin continue to be admired in their own countries. Up to 51% of Russian adults respect, like, or even admire Stalin, for example, despite his devastating legacy and the loss of life he helped bring about. Why is this sort of longing for these socialist or communist dictators, rather, despite their legacy, which is a legacy of death, of destitution, and all the rest of it?
Yeah, Russia is an extreme case there, but you get similar results in some of the other Central and Eastern European states. They would not idolize a socialist regime that actually existed, but they would say there were some good aspects and it could have been differently. They just somehow misunderstood the ideas. In that case, in that sense, this is more similar to the revival of socialism that we've had here in Britain, where this is not a nostalgia for any system that's ever existed anywhere. It's more the idea that it could be totally different. And in those places, it's a mix of that. In Russia, it's, I think, the pure nostalgia. They wouldn't even say they misunderstood the idea. It's just, you know, Stalin was the good guy. I'm guessing, I don't know enough about Russia, but my guess would be that in this case, this is more about nationalism than it is about socialism. So they're thinking not Stalin the socialist with his five-year plans, but more Stalin the strong leader who was feared at the world stage. Mm. So this is more longing for a time when the Soviet Union was a big, respected global power.
Which could be different to what If you ask some people in East Germany, I remember watching a documentary, and some people were questioned on the streets, and they said what they missed was the security, oddly enough. The security of actually having a job that was fixed and guaranteed, because it was provided by the state.
Yes. Yeah, it is aspects like that. And mostly, it's not even so much anything to do with the economy, but rather you get people talking about security in the sense of low crime rates, law and order. Of course, that's something that we could have in principle in a Western country as well. It could have a very tough law and order approach, but it's I don't think what happens here is that people on the left often quote these figures gleefully, these surveys, saying, oh, look, the Central Eastern Europeans are missing socialism. There's your capitalism. People don't want it. They have bias, remorse. But actually, it's a bit more diffuse. If somebody says, I miss the GDR, or I miss the People's Republic of Poland or whatever, you have to ask them more specifically, what is it exactly that you miss? Mm-hmm. Is it the planned economy? Is it socialism that you miss? Because in a lot of cases you get a confusion, because some of these systems were, while they were socialist, were also in some ways quite small c conservative. So the GDR was the sort of place that in some ways Peter Hitchens, I think, would have liked, because Peter Hitchens is still banging on about the corrupting influence of rock music in the West. There you could say, well, the East Germans kept that out, or at least for a while. The social and cultural revolutions that happened in the West is something that didn't really happen over there. And there's also the fact that they had much less immigration. That was one of the things that changed most rapidly, I guess, for East Germans in the 90s, that before that time, you would almost never see someone with a different skin color or someone of a different ethnicity. And suddenly that would become the norm. And as always with social changes of that kind, you get some people who welcome it, some who are indifferent, and some who hate it. And when you then ask 20 years on, 30 years on, and probably 40 years on at some point, do you miss the good old days? Some people will say yes, but they will be mixing a lot of things together. It's I remember that there were always commentators being puzzled about why in Eastern Germany today there's always been a lot of voter migration between the socialists and the far right, where the standard commentator would say, well, that doesn't make sense. Why would you move from one extreme to the other? Whereas both could be a form of nostalgia. The Socialist Party would represent nostalgia for the old socialist economy, whereas the far right would represent a nostalgia for the time when almost 100% of the population was white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting.
But it's not necessarily something progressive.
Yeah.
You can't assume that if somebody says, oh, the GDR was good in some ways, that that person must be a progressive left-winger and a socialist.
It's disingenuous to argue that they're longing for the halcyon days of a planned economy. It's actually, there are other factors at play, and they're missing more than that.
And it could also just be a bit of idle talk. It's a bit like, I guess, when sometimes people in the north of England would say, I miss the days when everybody was working in a coal mine.
Yeah.
But that's talk is cheap if you actually put up a time machine and said, okay, you can go back to those days. You just said you missed it. Here's the time machine. How many people would actually go in there?
Yeah.
I think close to zero.
Definitely. Now, according to a you touched on it in your remarks just there, but according to a recent poll, almost half of the UK's under 35s agreed with the statement that communism could have worked. Now, on the anniversary of 30 years since the fall of the wall, what does this tell us about the legacy, the lasting legacy of the ideology that saw the erection of the wall to begin with?
Yeah, I guess the trouble is that with socialism, there is such a massive difference between the way it was originally supposed to be, the way it was described by early socialist theorists, and the way it actually turned out. So there is just, when you observe this massive gap between intention and reality, there is just this temptation to believe that they cannot have been honest.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot start with this intention and then build something like that. If you start with such noble intentions, you cannot then build such a monstrosity. And therefore, there is the temptation to believe at some point this was just led astray, they misunderstood socialism, or they never really believed in it, they just used the word. And that's what makes socialism different from other totalitarian ideologies. Nobody could say the fascists had good intentions and then the wrong people took over. There, it's clear that right from the start, they had the intentions to create the thing that they actually did create. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there is no such gap between original intentions and actual outcomes. But I'd say it isn't just Marx and early thinkers who described socialism as a workers' paradise where everything would be hunky-dory. It's also actual socialist leaders, people like Lenin, people like the leaders of the East German Socialist Party. They didn't anticipate that it would turn out that way. I think they started honestly with good intentions.
The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
That is the problem. But you can't blame them for having bad intentions right from the start. I remember reading a book by Lenin, The State and Revolution. That's a book that he wrote literally a few weeks before he came to power, so closest thing to a manifesto. What's astonishing about that book is that there is such a big difference between the society that he describes in that book and the type of society that the Soviet Union then really was. Mm-hmm. He really did not start with the intention of building a totalitarian dystopia. Most of the book is about how the socialist state wouldn't have to do much, about how it would just run itself and you wouldn't really need a police force. He talks about how you need a bit of a police force in the beginning to neutralize counter-revolutionaries, but that sounds very much like a one-off, something that's done in a year or two. And then it would be just like a big working men's club where you've got lovely communities coming together, managing their affairs jointly, and that would be that. And that was always the intention. It's just that once these people are in power, they notice, things don't just run themselves. You can't just take away market mechanisms and expect everything to just run itself. And that's when it turns totalitarian, because that's when they realize it's either a totalitarian socialism or no socialism at all. That's the reason why the Berlin Wall was built as well. It's not that they came to power with the intention of dividing a country and shooting people who tried to leave. It's just that at that point, when it was built, that was the last resort. There was nothing else that they could have done. They had lost something like 3 million people. Proportionately, that's more than Venezuela has lost due to emigration, refugees. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Usually heavily biased towards people who were highly skilled in the prime of their careers. And they then realized you can't plan an economy in this way. We have mm-hmm. to do something.
Now, you mentioned Lenin's sort of rosy optimism. What is close to a manifesto. Trendy millennial commentators in 2019, with their sort of cushy book deals, keep advocating a kinder, gentler form of socialism that would just allow, you know, you've got this fully automated luxury communism, for example, where things just happen. It just happens organically because of technology now. So you would argue, Christian, wouldn't you, that given the evidence, given the reams and reams of evidence, the test cases that have gone horribly wrong, without exception, that it's inevitable that socialism will always lead to the kind of curtailment of freedom, coercion, and a lowering of living standards and GDP that we saw in East Germany?
Yes, maybe socialists need to read their own classics. I think if some of the trendy millennial socialists read something like that Lenin book, they would think, this sounds suspiciously like me. I think they would probably have the expectation that Lenin was some sort of left-wing version of Hitler, some horrible person who came along and hijacked the idea. But no, that wasn't the case at all. He did have the idea of a socialist society that he also advocated a kind socialism. The way he describes it, it doesn't sound unkind. There was never somebody who came along and had the intentions of being a Stalin figure right from the start. It's just that they then grow into these figures because that's the only way that that they can make it work.
And then given you mentioned North and South Korea earlier, I wonder, Do you think the Berlin Wall falling was actually inevitable, given that human nature is, you know, you describe the way in which if you try and shut down market mechanisms, the only way you can do that, the only way you can control people like that is through coercive control. Actually, you know, whether that be beating people through a totalitarian state or whatever. Do you think the likes of North Korea falling into, adopting more market mechanisms and capitalism, embracing capitalism in a way in which China potentially has, and East Germany did, do you think that's inevitable in the end? Do you think in the end communism, socialism is always destined to just fail?
It's destined to fail, but that doesn't mean that it's destined to disappear. I remember people saying that about North Korea 20 years ago, that this regime can't last much longer and they're still here. Unfortunately, it can fail and still drag on. That is the problem. I guess the only way in which they could have something seriously destabilizing the regime would be if there was some way in which lots of people could escape. Mm. If some crack opened, because that was the problem that was the prelude to the fall of the Berlin Wall, that it was actually Austria and Hungary starting to dismantle the border fence, and then you had East Germans traveling through Czechoslovakia to Hungary, which they were allowed to travel to other socialist states, and then they just escaped from Hungary to Austria. If something like that happened in Korea, if they could somehow get out in large numbers, that could seriously destabilize them.
Mm. And then I wonder if to end, and I'd like you to be to elaborate on this one, but 30 years on, what is it that you wish, because you've wrote books, you've wrote papers, you've wrote, you name it, on the sort of terror of socialism and what it leads to. What do you wish we would learn 30 years on from the wall? What do you wish we would learn from the failure of that ideology and from the success of policies that aren't particularly popular but are proven to work? What do we need to have a truly free society? One that the trendy millennials would tell you that only can come from adopting socialism.
Well, I'd like to see a greater understanding of why it is that socialism turns totalitarian, even if you have good intentions, that there are just specific reasons for that happening, that once you have a planned economy, you cannot combine that with local autonomy. You cannot say we have a 5-year plan, but you can do whatever you like. You're perfectly free to go about your own affairs. Once you have a central plan in place, even if it were somehow drafted democratically, even if you had 50% plus one of the population approving of this, you would then still need to be able to enforce it. You have to give people production quotas, and they then have to comply with them. And that cannot be done in any way other than an authoritarian way. Even if you could somehow combine it with democracy, it would still be a totalitarian kind of democracy. It would not be a liberal democracy which allows individual freedom. It would then be like intense group pressure where even if it is democratic, it still doesn't allow individuals room for deviation. And even the democratic socialism, even that cannot really be done, because economic planning is just something that isn't amenable to democracy. We're talking about handling tons of highly technical facts and data, and ultimately this is something which can only be done by expert planners. There is just no way in which you could organize a whole economy democratically. You would have to have a referendum on the production of everything, and then the sequencing would matter. Do we decide how many razor blades to produce before or after we decide on other things that also need metal and plastic? There are just too many variables to consider. This isn't something that you can work out in a democratic process. It will inevitably always lead to massive centralization of power and technocratic rule. We can already see this in the sectors that are already socialized today. We have large parts of the economy that are collectivized already, nationalized, and in some cases maybe you can make a good case for that. I'm not an anarchist. There would, even in my ideal society, there would still be a state. I just wouldn't idolize it. I don't buy the idea that just because something is owned by the state, it's run democratically by the people. That's the socialist idea that socialists keep coming up with again and again since Lenin. He already said you would just have the working class taking over from the capitalists, and the working class will run things democratically. Well, what does this mean in practice? The working class is just an abstraction. An individual working class person can own things, an individual working class person can make decisions, but the working class as a whole cannot. It's just an abstract concept, something that sociologists come up with, but the working class as such cannot make decisions. You can only have individual working class people getting together as a group and making decisions about something that concerns their own life, but they cannot as a class run a whole society, a whole economy jointly, and neither can the capitalists. The capitalist class is also just an abstraction. It's not true that you have this cabal of people who get together and coordinate everything. You just have individual capitalists in competition with one another, and they don't see themselves as part of a class or a cohesive group. And getting away from this focus on big groups, which only exists in the minds of a Marxist intellectual, which in reality consists of millions of disparate individuals, and they don't see themselves as a group. They have no meaningful way to coordinate their actions. And just realizing that modern economies are too complex to be run in a democratic or in a planned way. It's all well and good to do this in a small group, and when we're talking about relatively simple economic matters, you can have a worker cooperative run in a democratic way. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. But there is the problem of scalability. What works in a small group cannot be scaled up to a country of 65 million people, mm-hmm. or even 18 million as the GDR originally had, although immigration then saw to that quickly.
No, I know I said that was the last question, but you've wrote before on how you're not entirely optimistic that we're not destined to repeat the mistakes of the past. You actually think that given the sentiment, the pro-socialism sentiment of the next generation, that you're not overly optimistic. We're not going, you know, we'll not end up adopting socialism even in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
And do you think 30 years on that is actually a real risk?
Absolutely. That can absolutely happen, yes.
Why?
It came up, well, there are all these surveys about socialism being back in fashion. If it were one or two, I'd say, okay, this is maybe due to the way they phrased the question, or maybe it's a misunderstanding of the word or so, but it's a fairly persistent pattern repeated across lots of surveys. It seems to be independent of how exactly the question is formulated, and it isn't just the word socialism in or the word communism in the abstract, is also, once you describe specific policies, that still retains the popularity. So nationalization is now considered, so it's cool to be in favor of nationalization, oddly enough, even though this would just create big bureaucracies. But there is this idea that we're going to work it out, we'll do it differently. And I think a lack of awareness that that's what all the predecessors would also have said. That is what Lenin would have said, that is what Mao Zedong would have said, and that is what the leaders of the East German Socialist Party also said.
Well, let's hope that they're reading your Twitter account, Christian.
They should, yes.
And what is your Twitter account so people can find you?
It's @k_Niemietz, NIEMIETZ.
They should all check it out and actually read your book, actually, which is absolutely fantastic and one of the best I've ever read on the topic. But I wonder what our listeners think. Let us know at IEA London. You can subscribe to this podcast anywhere that you get your podcast.